success, yeah. We should be proud that we are free, and our free press reflects our democracy. Those praying voices on the right of the house are echoed down the street of shame, where politics mix with bingo and tits in a money and numbers game, where they offer you a feature on stockings and suspenders next to a call for stiffer penalties.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert McChesney, who's the Gutskill Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. Robert McChesney and John Nichols have co-authored The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism, and What Can Be Done to Fix It. And he is the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. His latest book, co-authored with John Nichols, is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McChesney.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And I take it that that you're concerned here that these media properties that have been up for sale, Newsweek for the second time, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times is on, and the Chicago Tribune are on the block, and there's even rumors that the Koch brothers might buy one or both. That you're concerned that these media properties are becoming playthings for billionaires, and that we are so pathetic in a sense that our best hope is that we end up with a benevolent, benign billionaire buying them. Is that how bad it is?
Well, I wouldn't put it necessarily exclusive like that. But the context, I think, that's important here, and what I guess I'm trying to do when I talk about the Bezos story with the Washington Post or even the Koch brothers story is to say, look, let's look at the broader context, which is that the value of commercial journalist properties, and we look primarily at newspapers, those are the last people doing journalism with reporters for the most part. But the value has plummeted because Wall Street has decided, and I think for good reason, that there's no profits to be made doing journalism anymore. It's no longer a commercially viable undertaking. And investors are voting with their feet. You know, the resources going to journalism have plummeted in the last 20 years, probably down to 30-40% of what they were on a per capita basis. Say 1990, 1992, and we're seeing newsrooms just drying up, like there's been, you know, a dust bowl hit them or something. And so what's happened as a result of that is that some of the great monopoly properties of the past, the great newspapers, have seen their prices plummet, and billionaires willing to buy them and pay, like in the case of the Washington Post, $250 million for a property that would have cost $5 or $6 billion probably 10 years ago. Willing to pay for that and then sustain the losses annually, and there will be losses annually, gets the privilege of having tremendous political influence, gets the privilege of setting the political agenda in Washington to a large extent. And that's why these guys are buying the papers. Jeff Bezos isn't buying the Washington Post because he thinks it's a really brilliant commercial investment on its own. That's ridiculous. He's not a dummy. The Koch brothers aren't thinking about the L.A. Times and the Chicago Tribune. They think that's a really smart investment. That's ridiculous. What they do know is that it gives you great political influence, because even though newspapers are dying, they're the last game in town, and no one else is out there doing journalism. It's not like the Internet has spawned really vibrant, healthy replacements. You know, it's still a bunch of people just scrapping it together with baling wire and chewing gum. There's no money there for journalism anymore than there's money for newspapers doing journalism. And as a result, if you own one of these papers, you can really set the agenda. And in the case of Bezos specifically, I don't think there's any question that he has political ambitions. I mean, if he was just some benevolent philanthropist, he would make this he would do this through his foundation and make it a nonprofit trust and set it up in such a way that it would be independent and have some integrity, sort of like the Scott Family Trust with The Guardian in Britain, which is, you know, one of the great papers of the world. But that wasn't his ambition. I think he wants to own it. He wants to have the most powerful paper in Washington, probably one of the two or three most powerful papers in the United States, and have the ability to influence politics, and we've learned in the last few days as we look more closely, and I've written about Digital Disconnect, he and his company have very strong stakes in some of the most important political issues before the American people.
But Robert Luchesi, has there ever been in this country a basic need for journalistic professionalism? My reading of history is that it's all sort of happened by accident, and because the, you know, in television, Bill Paley had some sense of integrity and some sense of public service. You've had these bilious billionaires like the McCormicks and the Hearsts and others over the decades using newspapers as personal propaganda outlets. I mean, we don't have a BBC that's insulated against political interference. And, of course, PBS is completely dependent, and so is NPR, on government funding. So they're hopeless compared to the BBC. You know, we what sets our journalistic standard? I mean, are we simply lucky to still have an LA Times and a New York Times, and are they endangered species?
Well, you got a lot of questions in there, Ian.
Right.
Let's start with professional journalism. We had a stridently partisan journalism for the first 140 years of American history. You know, in the 19th century, if a newspaper was a Republican paper and all newspapers were party identified, there's a good chance they wouldn't even mention Democratic candidates for office. You know, they just would ignore them. It was stridently partisan. And that system worked fairly well. It had its ridiculous stuff too, but in general, I think historians look fondly upon a highly partisan press, as long as there are multiple viewpoints and it's easy to start a new newspaper. It's not a bad system, and a lot of our greatest democracies have had partisan systems. What happened in the early 20th century, newspapers became very profitable. They also became highly concentrated, and they remained partisan. And this created the great crisis of the early 20th century, the Citizen Kane era, when, you know, there's only one or two newspapers in most American cities, except the largest cities, and they have very strong political viewpoints. They're very partisan, and it's impossible to start anyone to compete with them. And that's what led to the birth of professional journalism, because smart publishers realized, you know, this is killing us all if people don't trust the content of newspapers and if we become a source of scandal and controversy. And this was the idea of separating the ownership from the editors and reporters, separating the advertisers from the editors and reporters. So the theory was that what you read off the editorial page could be in any of the professional newspapers, because the professional journalists would be doing it without any bias or any political agenda that they're pushing. Now, this isn't the show to go into how ridiculous that is or how impossible that is, but it's not totally impossible. I mean, you can try it, and it can be somewhat effective. And one of the great stories in American history is how professional journalists, working reporters in the Newspaper Guild, tried very hard to create a different type of professional journalism that was sort of more adversarial towards everyone in power, rather than just regurgitating what people in power were saying, accurately reporting it, which is what it devolved to in the United States. So at any rate, professional journalism has been struggling with commercial pressures now for about 30 years, because there's so much need to make money and desire to make money that the sort of traditional sort of prohibition that was existed for a good 20, 30, 40 years from mid-century into the 70s, you know, has given way increasingly to commercial pressures and that have warped and shaped the news. And this is something that media critics like myself wrote about a lot, especially in the 80s and 90s and into the last decade. But I think it's been overwhelmed by the tidal wave of the economic disintegration of journalism, which has sort of really become the dominant story. We're just seeing the elimination of journalism as a commercially undertaken enterprise. And that's the true story that backs up what we're dealing with here, not just the decline of professionalism and the decline of quality, but it's the elimination of journalism. Not the elimination of news, mind you. There are still going to be news channels and news websites, but they're not going to really do much reporting. That it's going to be mostly public relations spin. And all the new research shows that pretty much 80% of what's called news is directly out of public relations or just a verbatim quote of someone in power.
Well, you can see, for example, if you watch, and people can't, of course, if you watch CNN International, it's actually a news channel. If you watch CNN Domestic, it's kind of trivial, you know. I mean, you can see the difference. So my question, I know it was a multifaceted, loaded question, but I'm trying to figure out here what force is there in the United States to maintain a level of where we actually know that there's a standard of journalism and that there is a standard that's set. And I guess at this point it's set by what, the New York Times. I mean, in other words, the BBC, at least – because it's politically insulated, does set a kind of standard. Fleet Street is the way you described, 18th century American. You know, and most of the other democracies have the full spectrum of left-wing papers and all the way to the right. We don't. We have these homogenized, you know, papers where they have balance because I guess the owners don't want to offend half of their readers who are Democrats and half of their readers who are Republicans. So they have, you know, on the one hand and on the other hand. But what's protecting us from complete commercialization of and trivialization of news?
Nothing. I think the real issue here is if commercial interests have abandoned journalism, if the value of these products is going down, if they're only being bought now basically so they give the power so you can influence politics and the people are interested in them, like the dude down in San Diego bought the San Diego Daily Paper, who's the right-wing guy, Manchester is his name, and uses it basically to push his political agenda in San Diego. If that's the sort of, that's the future of journalism. We went through a wave between 2008 and 2011 when hedge fund people gobbled up most of the newspapers and they said, hey, we'll come in with our brilliant financial genius minds and figure out a way to make money. And they all threw in the towel. Then they started selling them off to, just billionaires who have a political axe to grind. That's our future, but that's not a future. I mean, that's just nowhere we can go. If we do nothing politically, and just let the quote-unquote market work its way, what we're going to have is a continued collapse of journalism, and then we'll have these sort of billionaires who will gobble up these franchises like they're doing and keep them alive so they can use them to push their political viewpoints. And then some might do it very subtly. I mean, I doubt Jeff Bezos is going to march into the Post newsroom and slam his fist on the table and demand coverage of Story X and Story Y. In fact, I think he'd find most of the Post coverage completely fine with his worldview. That's why it's probably a pretty easy deal for the two sides to hammer out. Bezos is stridently anti-labor. He doesn't want regulation of business. He doesn't want any antitrust enforcement against him. He wants low taxes or non-existent taxes on wealthy people. He doesn't like public education. He gets along fine with the Washington Post, which oftentimes is considered a liberal paper, but that's very much in its rearview mirror.
Again, I'm speaking of Robert McChesney, who's the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and he's written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. His latest book, co-authored with John Nichols, is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Bob, just the other day I spoke on this Time Warner cable spat with CBS. I spoke with Susan Crawford, who many people were hoping would become the new director of the FCC. She'd be kind of people were hoping they'd have – she's an Elizabeth Warren type of person. Instead, the person that got the job is a former lobbyist for the telecom monopolies. But she was pointing out that this key vote that's taking place, it's not a vote, it's a lawsuit, but it's the second, it's the court below the Supreme Court, the key Washington circuit court there of appeals that the Republicans have stacked for some time because of filibusters, the Democrats and Obama can't get anybody onto this court. And there are three or four vacancies. They're supposed to hear the overturning of the so-called Jenikowski rules that preserve net neutrality on the internet. So if the internet is the only alternative to what we've been discussing so far, which is the mainstream media and who owns it and what kind of future it's going to have, if the internet is the only alternative, sometime in September, unless Obama can get a couple of two or three people on this court, it's very likely that they're going to strike down net neutrality. So I don't understand why the American public, particularly out here in California and in New York and Dallas, where we can't get CBS now because we have this one pipe into our homes controlled by a monopoly. And they just don't give a damn about us. They're having their own little corporate battle. And it just shows you that it's a harbinger of what's going to happen when the corporations take over the internet and they control the pipe into your home. You're finished. Your means of communication information are completely gone.
Well, I can't disagree with you. It's a very important fight. And, you know, I think what is people are starting to see and what I tried to emphasize in my book, Digital Disconnect, is that the notion of the internet as this sort of competitive, wide open marketplace where anything goes and everyone's got a shot, you know, that there's a million Steve Jobs is out there just, you know, one break away from busting through with another great idea. This has very little to do with the actual internet that exists in the world today, which is one that is dominated by a small number of enormous companies that are, by economic standards, monopolies, meaning that these companies in their dominant area of profit-making have a market share very close to and oftentimes exceeding that John D. Rockefeller had with Standard Oil in the late 19th century. You know, Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, eBay, I think we all know the company's names. I mean, I'd add into that Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, who have a cartel that Susan Crawford writes about so brilliantly over internet access. And these huge companies collect most of the profits online. It's not spread around through a lot of people. In fact, 12 of the 30 largest companies in America in terms of market value are internet monopolies. It's quite extraordinary. And so this is the new world order. And these companies have inordinate political power in Washington. I mean, President Obama, Democrat, Republican alike, can barely control themselves in the presence of one of these companies' CEOs or their lobbying officers. They're really hot. They run the game. And so we have real problems here. And issues like net neutrality, when there's a lot of them that really have a strong opinion, the other ones aren't fighting back or they've given up. And we have another issue here, I think, that goes beyond the monopoly. And this gets back to the beginning of the conversation, which is that even if we have net neutrality protected so that the phone and cable companies can't censor websites or users on the internet, there's the fundamental problem of resources for journalism, to pay for it. Those countries that still have great journalism today or credible journalism, those countries that rank always at the top of the Economist annual list of the most democratic nations in the world, make public investments in journalism 40, 50, even 100 times more per capita than the United States. We're way off the democratic grid with every other country in the democratic world. And we're not even close to it in terms of what we spend on journalism, in terms of public and community media and the like. And, you know, we've got to get back on the grid because people need to earn a paycheck to do journalism. They need to eat. It can't be done just by volunteers any more than you would expect another public good, like education or fire departments, to be done by volunteers. And it's every bit as important as education or a fire department.
Well, but I was using the BBC example earlier, and all the other developed countries that you mentioned that are top of the list in terms of standard of living do have a public broadcasting. We have the NPR, which is and PBS, which have been, you know, Nixon set up PBS to fail and to be politically controlled, and NPR are looking over the shoulders at the Republican Congress all the time. So we have nothing like that. That seems to me to be a real, a vain wish. I mean, where's the political momentum? I mean, the point I was making, what Susan Crawford was making in the interview I did with a couple of days ago, was that we're not even paying attention to this case that's going to be heard in early September in the D.C. Circuit Court that could throw out net neutrality. And that will be absolutely a revolutionary fact, won't it?
Yes and no. You know, of course, as I'm sure Susan Crawford mentioned to you, the FCC created this entire problem on net neutrality when it, on its own, under Michael Pollan, reclassified cable to an information service. Right. And therefore, for instead of a telecommunication service, and therefore undermine its own ability to regulate it. And it has the right to change that decision at any time. The Supreme Court has reconfirmed that. So it actually has it wouldn't even have to have this court case if it did that. This is they basically handed this as a gift to the cable industry, and they don't have the courage to take it back because it's so absurd. It is an important issue. Don't get me wrong. I agree with net neutrality is an important issue. But the point I'm making is that I don't think that people aren't paying attention to the net neutrality case because they're too busy worrying about how to get public broadcasting in the United States. I don't think it's a trade-off there. Right. That's the real crisis. People should stop thinking about that and get back to net neutrality. The problem we have, though, is that the net neutrality case, and legal cases generally aren't followed at that level no matter what they are, but the net neutrality case is important. It's even if we have net neutrality, and we've had net neutrality on wireline communication pretty much until now. We've always had it, which is one of the reasons it's hard to explain, because we've never lost it. And we don't really have it on cell phones anymore. That's part of the Obama policy we lost. But we do have it on wireline internet. That doesn't solve the fundamental problem that the show started with, which is, why we don't have any journalism left, and what little we have is being bought up by a few billionaires who can get it on the cheap.
Right. Well, but in the last minute or so here, what are we left with, though, in terms of our political focus, our political energy? I mean, where this is, public supported radio, which is, independent, but we, don't have any reach compared to these other people in the media. So, I mean, it feels like a daunting task to build a movement here, but we got to do something.
It feels like a daunting task, but it's amazing. We can never predict the future, and looking backwards, we always think it's impossible to change anything. There's never been anyone who's looked ahead and said, things are going to change really easily in the future. We can't predict the future, and, that's the one lesson that should be reminded is every time we look around the world today at the radical changes that have taken place in so many countries that no one thought possible, even the smartest people in those countries, a year before Arab Spring, a year before the uprisings in this country or that country, the recent ones in Brazil, no one thought it possible. Then suddenly it happens, and everybody says, what took it so long? That same thing was true of the Occupy movement. So I think, we're in a situation that's not tenable in the United States. We have collapsing journalism. We have deep social problems not being addressed by a governing system. Something's going to give. It's in our interest that it gives way to democratic and humane outcomes. But this can't go on forever. How it's going to change, though, no one can predict. No one has any idea. But I do think it's clear from my research, the American people should not be underestimated. This is a vastly more progressive population than it's been at any time in my lifetime. And the right wing knows it. That's why they're doing everything in their power to make it possible to buy elections on one hand and suppress the votes of poor people on the other hand, because they know they can't win a fair election unless they rig it.
Well, Robert McChesney, let's have another conversation about this because obviously we need to, and I thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure, Ian. Good luck with everything.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Guskill Endowed Professor at the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's written several books on media and politics, hosts the weekly talk show Media Matters, and along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press. He is the co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, and the author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what the Washington Post Company did not sell to Jeff Bezos.